might be seen in her own face. Cigarette smoke wafted in front of her. It amazed her that anyone would smoke these days, and she couldn't help but feel it as a kind of assault.
"Say," Olive said, "that doesn't make you feel sick."
"What, smoking this?"
"Yes, I shouldn't think that would help the nausea."
"What nausea?"
"I thought you had the pukes."
"The pukes?"
Anne dropped the cigarette into the bottle of beer. She looked over at Olive, her dark eyebrows raised.
"You haven't been sick with the pregnancy?"
"Oh, no, I'm a horse."
Anne patted her belly. "I just keep spitting these things out with no problem."
"Apparently."
Olive wondered if the girl was tipsy from the beer.
"Where's your newest husband?"
"He's reading Theodora a story. It's nice to have them bonding."
Olive opened her mouth to ask what kind of bond Theodore had with his real father, but she stopped. Maybe you weren't supposed to say real father these days.
"How old are you, Mom?"
Anne was scratching at her cheek.
"I'm 72, Olive said, "and I wear a size 10 shoe."
"Hey, cool. I wear a size 10. I've always had big feet." "You look good for 72, Anne added. "My mother's 63 and she..."
"She what?"
"Oh," Anne shrugged. "You know, she just doesn't look so good."
Anne hoisted herself up, leaned toward the grill where she picked up a box of kitchen matches.
"If you don't mind, Mom, I'm just going to have one more cigarette."
Olive did mind. This was Christopher's baby in there, trying to develop its own respiratory system right about now, and what kind of woman would jeopardize such a thing? But she said loudly,
"Do whatever you want. I don't give a damn."
"Praise God,"
came from above them.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," said Olive. "How can you stand that?"
"Sometimes I can't," Anne said, sitting down again hugely.
"Well," Olive said, looking at her lap, smoothing her skirt, "it's temporary, I guess."
She felt a need to look away as the girl lit a fresh cigarette. Anne didn't respond. Olive heard her inhale, then exhale, as the smoke drifted back toward Olive. A realization flowered within her. The girl was panicking. How did Olive know this? Never in 72 years having put a cigarette to her own lips? But the truth of it filled her. A light went on in the kitchen, and Olive watched through the grated windows as Christopher walked to the kitchen sink. Sometimes, like now, Olive had a sense of just how desperately hard every person in the world was working to get what they needed. For most, it was a sense of safety in the sea of terror that life increasingly became. People thought love would do it, and maybe it did. But even if, thinking of the smoking Anne, it took three different kids with three different fathers, it was never enough, was it? And Christopher, why had he been so foolhardy as to take all this on and not even, until after the fact, bother to tell his mother? In the near darkness, she saw Anne lean forward and put out her cigarette by sticking the tip into the baby pool. A tiny pfft of a sound. Then the girl tossed the rest over toward the chicken wire fence. A horse. Christopher had not been truthful when he'd emailed that Anne had the pukes. Olive put her hand to her cheek, which had grown warm. Her son, being Christopher, would never be able to say, "Mom, I miss you." He had said his wife had the pukes. Christopher stepped through the door and her heart rose toward him.
"Come join us," she said. "Come, sit down."
He stood, his hands loosely on his hips, and then he took one hand and rubbed the back of his head slowly. Anne stood.
"Sit here, Chris. If they're asleep, I'm going to take a bath."
He didn't sit on the stool, but pulled up a chair next to Olive and sat in the same sprawled-out way that he used to sit on the couch at home. She wanted to say, "It's awful good to see you, kid," but she didn't say anything, and he didn't either. For a long while they sat together like that. She would have sat on a patch of cement anywhere to have this, her son, a bright boy, bobbing in the bay of her own quiet terror.
So, you're a landlord, she finally said, because the oddity of that struck her now.
Yep.
Are they a nuisance?
No, it's just the guy and his religious parrot.
What's the fellow's name?
Sean O'Casey.
Really? How old is he? She asked, pulling herself up in her chair so her breath could move through.
Let's see.
Christopher sighed, shifting his weight. He was familiar to her now, slow-moving, slow-talking.
About my age, I think. Little younger.
He's not related to Jim O'Casey, is he? The fellow that drove us to school? They had a shoe full of children. His wife had to move once Jim went off the road that night. Remember that? She took the kids and went back to her mother. Is this guy upstairs one of those?
Haven't a clue, Christopher said.
He sounded like Henry, the absent-minded way Henry used to respond sometimes. Haven't a clue.
It's a common enough name, Olive admitted. Still, you might ask him if he's any relation to Jim O'Casey.
Christopher shook his head.
Don't care to.
He yawned, stretching out farther, his head thrown back. She had first seen him at a town meeting held in the high school gym. She and Henry were sitting on folding chairs near the back, and this man stood near the bleachers close to the door. He was tall, his eyes set back under that brow, his lips thin, a certain kind of Irish face, the eyes not brooding exactly, but very serious, looking at her with seriousness. She had felt a pulse of recognition, although she knew she'd never seen him before. Throughout the evening, they had glanced at each other a number of times. On their way out, someone introduced them, and she found he had come to town from West Annet, where he taught at the academy. He had moved with his family because they needed more room, living out there now by the Robinsons' farm. 6 kids, Catholic. Such a tall man he was, Jim O'Casey, and during the introductions, there seemed a whiff of shyness to him, a slight deferential ducking of his head, particularly as he shook Henry's hand, as though already apologizing for absconding with the affections of this man's wife, Henry, who didn't have a clue. As she stepped out of the school that night into the wintry air, walking with the talking Henry to their car in the far parking lot, she had the sensation that she had been seen, and she had not even known she'd felt invisible. The next fall, Jim O'Casey gave up his job at the academy and started teaching at the same junior high school Olive taught at, the one Christopher went to. And every morning, because it was on the way, he drove them both there and then back home again. She was 44. He was 53. She had thought of herself as practically old, but of course she hadn't been. She was tall, and the weight that came with menopause had only begun its foreshadowing, so at 44 she had been a tall, full-figured woman, and without one sound of warning, like a huge silent truck that suddenly came from behind as she strolled down a country road, Olive Kittredge had been swept off her feet.
If I asked you to leave with me, would you do it?
He spoke quietly as they ate their lunch in his office.
Yes, she said.
He watched her as he ate the apple he always had for lunch, nothing else.
You would go home tonight and tell Henry?
Yes,
she said. It was like planning a murder.
Perhaps it's a good thing I haven't asked you.
Yes.
They had never kissed, nor even touched, only passed by each other closely as they went into his office, a tiny cubicle off the library. They avoided the teacher's room. But after he said that day, she lived with a kind of terror and a longing that felt at times unendurable. But people endure things. There were nights she didn't fall asleep until morning, when the sky lightened and the birds sang and her body lay on the bed, loosened, and she could not, for all the fear and dread that filled her, stop the foolish happiness. After such a night, a Saturday, she had been awake and restless, and then had fallen asleep with suddenness, a sleep so heavy that when the phone beside the bed rang, she didn't know where she was, and then, hearing the phone picked up and Henry's soft voice,
"Ollie, the saddest thing happened. Jim O'Casey drove off the road last night, right into a tree. He's in intensive care down in Hanover. They don't know if he'll make it."
He died later that afternoon, and she supposed his wife was at his side, maybe some of the kids. She didn't believe it.
"I don't believe it," she kept saying to Henry. "What happened?"
"They say he lost control of the car."
Henry shook his head.
"Terrible," he said.
Oh, she was a crazy woman, privately. Absolutely nuts. She was so mad at Jim O'Casey. She was so mad, she went into the woods and hit a tree hard enough to make her hand bleed. She cried down by the creek until she gagged, and she fixed supper for Henry, taught school all day, and came home and fixed supper for Henry. Or some nights he fixed it for her because she said she was tired, and he'd open a can of spaghetti, and God, that stuff made her sick. She lost weight, looked better than ever for a while, which lacerated her heart with the irony. Henry reached for her often those nights. She was certain he'd had no idea. He would have said something, because Henry was that way. He did not keep things to himself. But in Jim O'Casey there had been a wariness, a quiet anger, and she had seen herself in him, had said to him once, "We're both cut from the same piece of bad cloth." He had just watched her, eating his apple.
"Oh, wait a minute," Christopher said, sitting up straight. "Maybe I did ask him. Yeah, he said his father was the one who drove into a tree in Crosby, Maine one night."
"What?"
Olive looked at her son through the darkness.
"That's when he got really religious."
"Are you serious?"
"Thus the parrot."
Christopher extended an arm upward.
"Oh, my goodness," said Olive.
Christopher dropped his arm with an exaggerated gesture of defeat or disgust.
"Mom, I'm kidding you for crying out loud. I have no idea who the guy is."
Through the kitchen window, Anne appeared, wearing a bathrobe and a towel around her head.
"Never liked that guy," Christopher said musingly.
"Who, the tenant? Keep your voice down."
"No, what's his name? Mr. Jim O'Casey. So stupid to drive into a tree."
There were fingernail clippings and soggy Cheerios on the table when Olive sat down with her cup of coffee in the morning. Anne was in the next room getting Theodore ready and called out,
"Good morning, Mom. Did you sleep?"
"Fine."
Olive raised a hand in a brief wave. She had slept better than she had in 4 years, since Henry's stroke. The same hopefulness she had felt on the plane seemed to return as she fell into sleep, holding her on a pillow of soft joy. Anne had no morning sickness. Christopher missed his mother. She was with her son. He needed her. Whatever rupture had occurred, starting years ago, as innocuously as the rash on Anne's cheek, spreading downward till it had split her from her son, it could be healed. It would be leaving its scar, but one accumulated these scars and went on, as she would now go on with her son.
"Help yourself, Mom," Anne called, "to anything."
"Righto,"
Olive called back. She got up and wiped the table with a sponge, though touching other people's nail clippings was hardly her thing. She washed her hands thoroughly. Other people's kids weren't her thing either. Theodore came and stood in the doorway, a knapsack on his back, so big that even while the child faced Olive, you could see the knapsack on both sides of him. She picked a donut from a box she had seen high on the counter and sat down again with her coffee.
"You shouldn't have a donut before you have your growing food," the boy told her, in a tone amazingly sanctimonious for a child.
"I'd say I'd grown enough, wouldn't you?" Olive replied, taking a big bite.
Anne appeared behind Theodore.
"Excuse me, honey pie,"
she said as she stepped past him to the refrigerator. She was holding the baby girl on her hip, the baby's head turning around to stare at Olive.
"Theodore, you need 2 juice boxes today. It's field trip day," she said to Olive, who was tempted to stick her tongue out at that damn little staring baby. "The school takes them to the beach, and I get worried about him getting dehydrated."
"I don't blame you," said Olive, finishing her donut. "Chris ever tell you about the sunstroke he got when we went to Greece? He was 12. A witch doctor came over and did some swoopy arm motions in front of him."
"Really?" said Anne. "Theodore, do you want grape or orange?"
"Grape."
"I think," Anne said, "grape makes you more thirsty. What do you think, Mom? Doesn't grape make you more thirsty than orange?"
"Haven't a clue."
"Orange, honey." And Theodore began to cry. Anne gave Olive a hesitant look. "I was going to ask you to walk him to school, just a block."
"No,"
Theodore cried. "I don't want her walking me to school. I don't want her walking me to school."
Shut the hell up, Olive thought. Chris was right. You are a little piece of crap.
Anne said, "Oh, Theodore, please don't cry."
Olive pushed back her chair. "How about I take Dog Face to the park?"
"You don't mind picking up his poops in the bag?"
"No," said Olive. "I certainly don't, having stepped in one myself."
She was, to be truthful, uneasy about walking the dog to the park, but the dog was a good boy. He sat while they waited for the light to change. She walked him past picnic tables and big garbage bins overloaded with food and newspapers and tinfoil streaked with barbecue sauce, and he did strain a bit on the leash toward all that, but when they got to the meadow, she let him run free, as Anne had said she could do.
"Now stay nearby," she said.
He sniffed around, not running off. She noticed a man watching her. He was young and wore a leather jacket, even though it was warm enough that you didn't need to wear a leather jacket. He stood beside the trunk of a huge oak and called to his dog, a short-haired white dog with a sharp pink nose. The man made his way over to her.
"Are you Olive?" he finally asked.
Her face got hot.
"Olive who?"
she said.
"Christopher's mother.
Anne said you were coming to visit."
"I see,"
said Olive, reaching into her pocket and finding her sunglasses.
"Well, here I am."
She put on her sunglasses and turned to watch for Dog Face.
"You staying at the house?"
the man asked eventually, and Olive didn't really think it was any of his business.
"I am," said Olive. "The basement's very nice."
"Your son stuck you in the basement?" the man said, and Olive especially didn't think that was nice.
"It's a very pleasant basement," Olive said. "It suits me quite well."
She looked straight ahead, but she could feel him looking at her. She wanted to say, "Haven't you ever seen an old lady before?" She watched her son's dog sniff the rear end of a passing golden retriever, whose heavy-breasted young owner held a metal mug in one hand, the leash in the other. She watched her son's dog sniff the rear end of a passing golden retriever, whose heavy-breasted young owner held a metal mug in one hand, the leash in the other.
"Some of these old brownstones have rats and mice in their basements," the man said.
"No rats," said Olive.
"A nice daddy long legs went by. Didn't bother me a bit."
"Your son's practice must do well. These places cost a fortune now." Olive didn't answer. That he should say this was vulgar.
"Blanche," called the man, starting after his dog. "Blanche, come here now."
Blanche had no intention of coming, Olive noted. Blanche had found an old dead pigeon, and the man went berserk.
"Drop it, Blanche, drop it."
Blanche had the mess in her pointed mouth and slunk away from her approaching owner.
"Jesus Christ," said the big-breasted woman with the golden retriever, because the bloodied insides of the pigeon's body were right there, sliding out of Blanche's mouth.
"Praise God,"
came a voice from the oak tree. Olive called to Dog Face, clicked the leash onto his collar, then turned and walked home. Right before she got to the house, She glanced behind her and saw the man crossing the street with Blanche on a leash and a parrot on his shoulder. A sense of disorientation came over her. Was that the tenant? That pretentious leather jacket, a manner that seemed to Olive confrontational. Unlocking the grated gate, she felt as though by 8 o'clock in the morning a small battle had been fought. She didn't think her son should be living in this city. He was not a fighter. The kitchen was empty. Upstairs, she heard a shower running. She sat down heavily in a wooden chair. She had once known each of their 6 names. Now she could remember nothing but the wife's name, Rose, and one girl, Andrea? Sean could very possibly have been one of the youngest, but how many thousands of Sean O'Casey's were wandering around, and did it even matter? As though remembering something heard about a distant relative, Olive sat in the dark kitchen and remembered a person, herself, who had once thought that if she left Henry for Jim, she'd have done anything for Jim's children. Her love had felt that huge. "Christopher," she said. He had stepped into the kitchen, his hair wet, dressed for work. "I think I met your tenant in the park. I didn't know he had a dog as well as a Christian parrot." Chris nodded, drank from a coffee mug as he stood by the sink. "I didn't care for him." Christopher raised one eyebrow.
"How surprising."
"Didn't think he was a bit nice. I thought Christians were supposed to be nice."
Her son turned to put his mug into the sink.
"If I had more energy, I'd laugh. But Annabelle was up again and I'm tired."
"Christopher, what's the story with Anne's mother?"
He wiped a kitchen towel across the counter in one swipe.
"She's an alcoholic."
"Oh, dear God."
"Yeah, she's a mess. And the father, dead now, praise God, as the parrot would say, was in the army. Made them do push-ups each morning."
"Push-ups? Well, I can see you two have a great deal in common."
"What do you mean?"
His face seemed to flush slightly.
"I was being sarcastic. Imagine your father making you do push-ups."
That he had no response unsettled her slightly.
"Your tenant wanted to know how you afforded this place," she said.
Chris scowled, familiar to her again.
"None of his damn business."
"No, that's exactly what I thought."
Christopher glanced at his watch, and she had a sudden fear of his leaving, of being left alone with Anne and those kids all day in this dark house.
"How long does it take you to get to work?"
"Half hour. The subway's packed at rush hour."
Olive had never been on a subway.
"Chris, do you worry about another attack?"
"Attack? Terrorist attack?"
Olive nodded.
"No, sort of. Not really. I mean, it's going to happen, so you can't just sit around waiting."
"No, I can see that."
Chris ran his fingers through his wet hair, gave his head a quick shake.
"There was a store on the corner here, run by guys from Pakistan. Hardly anything in the store, a few cupcakes, a bottle of Coke, clearly some kind of front. But I'd stop in to buy the paper each morning and the guy would be real nice. 'How you doing today?' he'd say, with his long yellow teeth showing. He'd give me this smile and I'd smile back, and it was sort of understood that he had nothing against me. But if he knew which subway was going to blow, he'd smile and watch me walk to get on it."
Chris shrugged.
"How do you know that?"
"I don't, but I do. The store closed. The guy said he had to go back to Pakistan. It was in his eyes, Mom, that's all I'm saying."
Olive nodded, looking at the big wooden table.
"Still, you like it here?"
"Pretty much."
But the day passed okay, and then another day passed. She took the dog to the park earlier so as to avoid Sean. And while everything remained strange, like a foreign country, she could not let go of a certain happiness inside her. She was with her son. At times he was talkative, at times he was silent, and he was most familiar to her then. She did not understand his new life, or Anne, who said things that seemed to come from a Hallmark card, but she did not see in Chris any signs of moroseness, and that's what mattered, that and simply being with him again. When Theodore called her Grandma, she answered, and while she really couldn't stand the child, she put up with him, reading him a story one night, though when she left out a word and he corrected her, she could have swatted his dark head. He was her son's family, and so was she. When she tired of the child, or when the baby cried, she retired to the basement and lay on the bed, thinking how glad she was that she had never left Henry for Jim. Not that she would have, although she remembered that she felt she would have, and what would have happened to Christopher then? On the third morning, when Anne returned from taking Theodore to school and Christopher was off at work, the baby splashed in the pool out back while Olive sat in the beach chair.
"Can you watch her, Mom, while I collect some laundry?" Anne asked,
and Olive said, "Of course." Annabelle fretted, but Olive tossed her a twig from nearby, and Annabelle slapped it against the water. Olive gazed up at the deck, looking for any sign of the parrot, who would sometimes say, unprovoked, "God is king."
"Hell's bells," Olive said,
then said it again, louder, and,
"Praise God,"
came from upstairs. She slipped off her sandals, scratched her feet, settled back in her chair, pleased to have maneuvered the response. It did sound just like her Aunt Aura. She got up, went into the kitchen to get a donut, and as she stood munching it by the sink, she suddenly remembered the baby.
"Oh, good God," she whispered,
and hurried outside. Annabelle was trying to stand up. Olive bent to steady the toddler, and Annabelle slipped. Olive moved around the edge of the pool, attempting to lift the child and keep her face out of the water. Annabelle got more and more agitated, slipping and crying, turning away from Olive.
"For the love of God, stop it now," Olive said,
and the baby stared at her and then cried again.
"Our Father who art in heaven," shrieked the parrot. "That's a new one," said Anne,
stepping into the backyard with a dish towel.
"She's trying to stand up," Olive explained, "and I couldn't quite get hold of her."
"Yeah, she's about ready to walk any day now."
Anne, in spite of her large belly, picked the child up easily. Olive returned to her chair, shaken with the effort of grappling with the baby. Her pantyhose were shredded from running around on this cement.
"Today's our wedding anniversary," Anne said,
putting the dish towel around the shoulders of the baby.
"It is."
"It is,"
Anne smiled, as though remembering something private.
"Let's warm you up, little goose."
Annabelle had spread her small legs on each side of Anne's bulbous belly, laid her wet head across Anne's big chest, and was sucking her thumb, shivering. So easily, Olive could have said, "Well, it'd have been nice of you to tell me you were getting married to begin with. It's a ghastly thing for a mother to find out later." But she only said,
"Happy anniversary, then."
That the baby had not drowned while she ate a donut had left her so relieved that the anniversary seemed, while a painful reminder of how left out she had been, nothing to quibble about.
"Did Chris tell you how we met?"
"Not exactly, not specifically."
He had told her nothing.
"In a singles group for divorced people. I'd just found out I was pregnant with Annabelle. You know how, when you get divorced, you do crazy things, and Annabelle was the result of a crazy thing. Weren't you chicken pie?"
She kissed the top of the child's head. This was the 21st century, thought Olive. It's not as though one had to rely on foam for birth control. But the still relieved Olive said with feigned generosity,
"That's a nice idea, a singles group for divorced people."
She nodded.
"You all have that experience in common."
She herself had gone to one meeting of a support group at the nursing home and found it absolutely foolish, with foolish people saying foolish things, including the social worker who ran it and said repeatedly in a sweet, calm voice, "To be angry about the event is normal." Olive never went back. Angry, she thought with disdain. Why be angry about a natural event, for God's sake? She couldn't stand the stupid social worker or the grown man who sat next to her and wept openly for his stroked-out mother. Absolutely foolish. Bad things happen, she wanted to say. Where have you been?
It was a therapy group, Anne said, so we could learn our own responsibility, accept our accountability, you know?
Olive didn't know. She said, Christopher married the wrong woman is what he did.
But the question is why, Anne said in a solicitous way, shifting the baby. If we learn why we do things, we won't make the same mistakes.
I see, said Olive. She stretched her feet and felt the soft opening of another big run in her pantyhose. She needed to go to a drugstore.
It was just wonderful. Chris and I became very committed to the process and committed to each other.
That's nice, Olive finally said.
The therapist is this amazing guy, Arthur. You just wouldn't believe how much we've learned.
Anne rubbed the dish towel against the baby's back, looked over at Olive. She said,
Anxiety is anger, Mom.
Is it? Olive thought of the girl's cigarettes.
Uh-huh, almost always. When Arthur moved to New York, we did too.
You moved here because of a therapist? Olive sat up straight in her beach chair. Is this a cult?
No, no. We wanted to move here anyway, but it's great because we still get to work with Arthur. Always plenty of issues to work on, you know?
I bet. Olive made, right then, a decision to accept all this. The first time around, Christopher married someone mean and pushy, and now he'd married someone dumb and nice. Well, it was none of her business. It was his life. Olive went down into the basement and dialed the white telephone. Cindy said,
How's it going?
Fine. Different country down here. Can you put him on?
She held the phone between her neck and shoulder, started to peel her pantyhose off, and remembered she had no other.
Henry, she said, today's their wedding anniversary. They're okay, but she's dumb, just like I thought. They're in therapy.
She hesitated, looked around.
You're not to worry about that, Henry. In therapy, they go straight after the mother. You come out smelling like a rose, I'm sure.
Olive drummed her fingers on the washing machine.
I have to go. She's doing some laundry down here. I'm fine, Henry. I'll be back in a week.
Upstairs, Anne was feeding the baby part of a baked sweet potato. Olive sat and watched her, remembering how one year for their anniversary, Henry gave her a keychain with a four-leaf clover pressed inside a piece of thick, clear plastic.
I called Henry and told him it was your anniversary.
Oh, sweet, said Anne, adding, anniversaries are nice, a little moment to reflect.
I liked getting the presents, Olive said.
Walking behind her son and his large wife and the big double stroller pushed ahead of them, Olive thought of her husband, in bed already, perhaps. They tried putting them to bed earlier than small children were put to bed.
"Spoke to your father today," she said,
but Christopher apparently did not hear her. He and Anne were speaking intently, their heads tilted toward each other as they pushed the stroller along. Oh, God, yes, she was glad she'd never left Henry. She'd never had a friend as loyal, as kind as her husband. And yet, standing behind her son, waiting for the traffic light to change, she remembered how in the midst of it all there had been times when she'd felt a loneliness so deep that once, not so many years ago, having a cavity filled, the dentist's gentle turning of her chin with his soft fingers had felt to her like a tender kindness of almost excruciating depth, and she had swallowed with a groan of longing, tears springing to her eyes.
Are you all right, Mrs. Kittredge?
The dentist had said. Her son turned to glance at her, and his lucid face was enough to keep her going, because she really was fatigued.
Young people had no idea that you got to a stage where you couldn't just gallivant around morning, noon, and night. 7 stages of life? Is that what Shakespeare said? Why, old age alone had 7 stages. In between, you prayed to die in your sleep. But she was glad she had not died. Here was her family, and here was the ice cream shop with an empty booth right up front. Olive sank gratefully onto the red cushioned seat.
"Praise God," she said,
but they didn't hear her. They were busy unbuckling the kids, arranging the baby in a high chair. Theodore, in his own chair, pulled up to the edge. Anne's stomach was too big to get her into the booth, so she had to trade places with Theodore, make him sit in the booth, which she did only when Christopher took the child's small wrists in one hand, leaned forward, and said quietly,
"Sit."
Something vaguely discomforting moved in Olive, but the child sat. Politely, he said he wanted vanilla ice cream.
"Christopher was always so polite," she said to him. "People used to compliment me on how polite my little son was."
Did Christopher and Anne exchange a glance? No, they were just getting ready to order. It seemed impossible to Olive that Anne carried within her the grandchild of Henry. But there you were. She ordered a butterscotch sundae.
"No fair," said Theodore. "I want a sundae."
"Well, okay, I guess," said Anne. "What kind?"
The kid looked distressed, as if the answer were beyond his comprehension. Finally, he said, putting his head down onto his arms,
"I'll have a vanilla cone."
"Your father would have ordered a root beer float," said Olive to Christopher.
"No," said Christopher. "He would have ordered a dish of strawberry ice cream."
"Nope," said Olive. "A root beer float."
"I want that. I want a root beer float," said Theodore, picking his head up.
"What is it?"
Anne said,
"They put lots of root beer in a glass, and then they float vanilla ice cream in it."
"I want it."
"He's not going to like it," said Christopher.
And he didn't. Theodore began to cry halfway through and said it wasn't what he thought it would be. Olive, on the other hand, enjoyed her butterscotch sundae immensely, eating every spoonful, while Anne and Christopher talked about whether Theodore should be allowed to order again. Anne was for it, Christopher against. Olive stayed out of it, but noticed that Christopher won. Walking home, she had more energy, undoubtedly from her ice cream, and also because Chris walked with her, while Anne pushed the stroller ahead of them, the children, thank God, quiet. Chris's podiatry practice was going well.
"People in New York take their feet very seriously," he said.
Often he saw 20 people a day.
"Good heavens, Chris, that seems a lot."
"I have a lot of bills to pay," he said, "and soon I'll have even more."
"I guess, well, your father would be proud."
It was getting dark. Through the lighted windows they passed, she could see people reading, watching television. She saw one man who appeared to be tickling his little son. A feeling of benevolence swept through her. She wished the best for everyone. In fact, saying good night once they got through the door, Olive felt she could have kissed them, her son, Anne, even the children, if she'd had to. But there was a feeling of distraction, and Chris and Anne said only, "Good night, Mom." Downstairs she went into the white basement. Stepping into the little closet of a bathroom, she flicked on the light and saw in the mirror that across her blue cotton blouse was a long and prominent strip of sticky dark butterscotch sauce. A small feeling of distress took hold. They had seen this and not told her. She had become the old lady her Aunt Aura had been when years ago she and Henry would take the old lady out for a drive, stopping some nights to get an ice cream, and Olive had watched as Aunt Aura had spilled melted ice cream down her front. She had felt repulsion at the sight of it. In fact, she was glad when Aura died, and Olive didn't have to continue to witness the pathetic sight. And now, she had become Aura.
But she wasn't Aunt Aura, and her son should have pointed this out the minute it happened, as she would have to him had he spilled something down his front. Did they think she was just one more baby they were carting around? She took the blouse off, ran hot water in the little sink, then decided not to wash it. She wrapped it in a plastic bag and stuck it into her suitcase. The morning was hot. She sat in the backyard on the beach chair. She had dressed before the sun came up and had climbed the stairs cautiously, not daring to turn on any lights. Her pantyhose had caught on something in the basement, and she had felt the little series of runs in them. She crossed her legs, bobbing a foot, and as it got light, she saw the runs had spread up over her thick ankles. Anne appeared first, seen through the kitchen window, holding the baby on her hip. Christopher came up behind, touched Anne lightly on the shoulder as he reached past her. Olive heard Anne say, "Your mom will take Dogface to the park, and I'll get Theodore ready, but I'm letting him sleep a little later."
"Isn't it wonderful when he sleeps those extra minutes?"
Chris had turned around and was running his fingers through Anne's hair. Olive was not taking Dogface to the park. She waited until they were both close enough to the window, and she said,
"Time for me to go."
Christopher ducked his head.
"I didn't know you were out there. What did you say?"
"I said," Olive responded loudly, "that it's time for the damned old lady to go."
"Praise Jesus," came from the upstairs deck.
"What do you mean?"
asked Anne, sticking her neck toward the window at the same time the baby's foot kicked over a carton of milk on the counter.
"Shit," said Christopher.
"He said shit,"
Olive called up to the deck and nodded quickly when the parrot squawked,
"God is king."
"Yes, indeed," Olive said. "He is indeed."
Christopher walked out to the backyard, closing the screen door behind him carefully.
"Mom, stop it. What's happening?"
"It's time for me to go home. I stink like fish."
Christopher shook his head slowly.
"I knew this was going to happen. I knew something would trigger things off."
"What are you talking about?" Olive said. "I'm simply telling you it's time for me to go home."
"Then come inside," Christopher said.
"I guess I don't need my son telling me what to do," Olive said.
But when Chris went back inside, murmuring to Anne, she got up and joined them in the kitchen. She sat in a chair by the table. She had hardly slept and felt shaky.
"Did something happen, Mom?" Anne asked. "You weren't going to leave for a few more days."
She'd be damned if she was going to tell them how they'd let her sit there and dribble stuff down herself. They'd have treated their own kids better than that, wiped the mess off. But her, they let just sit there with butterscotch sauce all down her front.
"I told Christopher when he first asked me here that I'd stay for 3 days. After that, I stink like fish."
Anne and Christopher looked at each other.
"You said you'd stay a week,"
Chris said warily.
"Right, because you needed help, but you weren't even honest enough to say that."
A fury was rumbling up through her, ignited further by their sense of conspiracy, how Chris had stroked Anne's hair, the look they had exchanged.
"God, I hate a liar. No one brought you up to lie, Christopher Kittredge."
From Anne's hip, the baby stared at her.
"I asked you to come visit," Christopher said slowly, "because I wanted to see you. Anne wanted to meet you. We were hoping we could just have a nice time. I was hoping that things had changed, that this wouldn't happen. But, Mom, I'm not going to take responsibility for the extreme capriciousness of your moods. If something happened to upset you, you should tell me. That way we can talk."
"You've never talked your whole damn life. Why are you starting now?"
It was the therapist, she realized suddenly. Of course, that foolish Arthur fellow. She ought to be careful. This would get repeated in a therapy group. Extreme capriciousness of your moods. That was not Christopher's voice. Good God, they'd discussed her to pieces already. The thought caused her whole body to shudder.
And what are you talking about? The capriciousness of my moods. What in hell is that all about?
Anne was mopping at the milk with a sponge, still holding the baby. Christopher stood calmly in front of her.
You kind of behave like a paranoid, Mom. You always have. At least a lot, anyway. And I never see you taking any responsibility for it. One minute you're one way, the next you're furious. It's tiring. Very wearing for those around you.
Beneath the table, Olive's foot bounced like the devil. Quietly, she said,
I don't need to sit here and be called a schizoid. I've never heard of such a thing in all my life. A son turning around and calling his mother schizoid? God knows I didn't like my mother, but I never—
Olive, said Anne, please, please stay calm. No one called you any names. Chris was only trying to tell you that your moods change kind of fast sometimes, and it's been hard for him growing up, you know, never knowing.
What in God's name would you know about it? Were you there?
Olive's head was all twirly inside. Her eyesight didn't seem right.
I suppose both of you now have degrees in family psychology.
Olive, Anne said.
No, let her go. Go, Mom, that's fine. I'll call you a car service to get you to the airport.
You're going to send me out there alone? For God's sake!
In 1 hour, I have to go to work, and Anne has the kids to take care of. We can't drive you to the airport. The car service will be fine. Anne, why don't you call them? You'll have to go to the ticket counter, Mom, to get your ticket changed, but there shouldn't be a problem.
Amazingly, her son started to collect dirty dishes from the counter and load the dishwasher.
You're kicking me out? Just like that?
Olive said, her heart pumping ferociously.
See, there's an example, Chris answered calmly, loading the dishwasher calmly. You say you want to leave, then accuse me of kicking you out. In the past, it would make me feel terrible. But I'm not going to feel terrible now because this is not my doing. You just don't seem to notice that your actions bring reactions.
She got up, holding the edge of the table, and made her way to the basement where her bag was already packed. She had packed it in the night. She brought it back up the stairs, panting.
The car will be here in 20 minutes, Anne said to Christopher,
and he nodded, still loading the dishwasher.
I can't believe this, Olive said.
I shouldn't wonder. Christopher had started scrubbing a pot now. I always found it unbelievable myself, but I just don't want to put up with it anymore.
You haven't put up with me for years, Olive shouted. You have treated me poorly for years.
No, said her son quietly. I think if you think about it, you'll see that the story is quite different. You have a bad temper. At least, I think it's a temper. I don't really know what it is. But you can make people feel terrible. You made Daddy feel terrible.
Chris,
said Anne in a warning kind of way, but Christopher shook his head.
I'm not going to be ruled by my fear of you, Mom.
Fear of her? How could anyone be afraid of her? She was the one who was afraid. He kept scrubbing the pots, the pans, wiping down the counters, all the while answering her calmly. Whatever she said, he answered calmly, calm as the Muslim who sold him a newspaper each morning before sending him off on a subway to blow up. Wasn't that paranoid? Her son was the one who was paranoid. She heard Theodore call from the top of the stairs.
Mommy, come here. Mommy!
Olive started to cry. Everything became blurry, not just her eyes. She said things with more and more fury, and Christopher answered calmly, still washing kitchen things calmly. She kept crying. Christopher was saying something about Jim O'Casey, something about him being a drunk driving into a tree.
You'd scream at Daddy like Jim's death was his fault. How could you do that, Mom? I don't know what I hated more. when you went after him and sided with me, or when you went after me.
Christopher was tilting his head as though really considering this.
What are you talking about? Olive cried. You with your new wife. She's so nice, Christopher, it makes me puke. Well, I hope you have a damn nice life since you've got it all figured out.
Back and forth, Olive crying, Christopher calm, until he said quietly,
Okay, get your bags. Here's the car.
The line to get to the gate, the security line, was so long it went around a corner. A black woman wearing a red airport vest kept saying in the same plangent tone,
People, move around to the corner and against the wall. Move around to the corner and against the wall.
Twice Olive approached her.
Where do I go?
Olive asked her, thrusting forward her ticket.
This line right here, the woman said, raising an arm toward the long line.
Her hair had been straightened and seemed like a badly fitting bathing cap with whiskers around its back rim.
Are you sure?
Olive said.
The line right here.
Raising her arm again, her indifference was impenetrable.
You were the scariest teacher at the school, Mom.
Standing in line, she looked to those near her for some confirmation that this was ridiculous, standing in a line this long, that something must be wrong. But people who met her eye looked away with no expression. Olive put her sunglasses on, blinking. Everywhere she looked, people seemed removed and unfriendly. As she got closer, she didn't understand. The line spread into one mass of people who all seemed to know what she didn't. Where to go? What to do?
I need to call my son,
she said to a man standing near her. What she meant was that she had to leave the line to get to a payphone because surely if she called Christopher, he would come get her. She would beg. She would bawl. Anything it took to be saved from this hell. It had just gone terribly wrong, that's all. Sometimes things went terribly wrong. But looking around, there were no payphones anywhere she could see. Everyone had a cell phone stuck to their ear, talking, talking. They all had someone to talk to. His utter calm as he washed those dishes while she wept. Even Anne had had to leave the room.
Do you have no memory of these things at all? These days, they'd send a social worker right to the home if a kid showed up that way.
Why are you torturing me?
She had cried.
What are you talking about? All your life I have loved you, and this is what you feel?
He'd stopped washing the dishes, said just as calmly,
Okay, now I don't have anything left to say.
The man she had told she had to call her son looked at her, then looked away. She couldn't call her son. He was cruel, and his wife was cruel. Olive was moved along with the small sea of people. Move along, handbag on the rollers, move along, have your boarding pass out. A man, not nicely, motioning for her to step through the security arc, glancing down, saying without expression,
Take off your shoes, ma'am, take off your shoes.
She pictured standing before him, her shredded pantyhose exposed like some crazy lady.
I will not take off my shoes, she heard herself say. She said, I don't give a damn if the plane blows up, do you understand? I don't give one good goddamn if any of you are blown sky high.
She saw the security man give the slightest gesture of his hand, and two people were beside her. They were men, and in half a second a woman was there, too, security officials in their white shirts and special stripes above the pockets. In voices of great gentleness, they said,
Come this way, ma'am.
She nodded, blinking behind her sunglasses, and said,
I'd be glad to.
Criminal. That morning, Rebecca Brown stole a magazine, even though Rebecca was not ordinarily the type of person who stole things. Ordinarily, Rebecca wouldn't take the soap from a motel bathroom on Route 1. She'd never even think to take the towels. It was the way she had been raised. In truth, Rebecca had been raised not to do a lot of things, and she'd done a great many of them anyway. except for stealing. She had never done that. But in the bleak white of a doctor's office in the town of Maisie Mills, Rebecca stole a magazine. There was a story in it that she wanted to finish, and she thought, this is only a doctor's office, and only a magazine, so really, this is no big deal. The story was about an ordinary, balding, kind of out-of-shape man who came home for lunch every day and sat at the kitchen table with his wife, eating sandwiches and talking about things like getting the lawnmower fixed. It gave Rebecca the same hopeful feeling that she got sometimes when she walked down a side street at night and saw through the window some kid playing in his pajamas with a father ruffling the kid's hair. So when the nurse opened her glass window and called out a name, Rebecca rolled up the magazine and slipped it into her knapsack. She didn't feel bad about it. She felt pleased when she got on the bus and knew she could finish the story. But the man's wife wanted more from life than Saturday trips to the hardware store and eating sandwiches every day just because lunchtime had rolled around. And by the end of the story, the wife had packed up and left, and the man stopped coming home for lunch. He just stayed in his office at lunchtime, not eating anything. Rebecca felt sick when she finished the story. She was not a person who should read on a bus. The bus went around a corner, and the magazine fell. And when Rebecca picked it up, it was open to a picture of an ad for a man's shirt. The shirt looked like a painter's smock, gathered across the chest and kind of billowy. Rebecca turned the magazine, looked at it more. By the time she stepped off the bus, she had decided to order the shirt for David.
"You love it,"
the woman said over the telephone.
"It's all hand-sewn and all. A beautiful shirt."
The number had been an 800 number, and this woman taking the order had a southern accent. Rebecca thought her voice was like stepping into one of those television commercials for laundry soap where sunlight streams through a window across a shiny floor.
"Now let's see,"
the woman said.
"These come in small, medium, and large. Oh, honey, I've got to put you on hold."
"That's all right," Rebecca said. On the bus ride home, her stomach had started to feel like a wet balloon was in there with its inside stuck together. So she put the phone between her neck and shoulder and reached across the counter for the Maalox spoon. Maalox sticks to everything. You can't put the spoon in the dishwasher because even the glasses come out flecked with white. They had a serving spoon David called the Maalox spoon, and it stayed right there by the corner of the sink. Rebecca was standing there licking the Maalox spoon when her father's voice came into her head. It was in her head, but it was clear as a bell.
"I hate a person who steals," he said.
The day her father died, Rebecca read in a magazine about a psychic woman who helped police solve murders. The woman said she did it by reading the thoughts of the dead people, that dead people still had thoughts even after they were dead.
"I'm sorry about that,"
said the woman with her southern accent. "It's okay," Rebecca said.
"Now,"
said the woman,
"is your husband's width more in his shoulders or in his stomach region?"
"He's not my husband," Rebecca said. "Not exactly. I mean, he's my boyfriend."
"Well, sure,"
the woman said.
"And is your boyfriend's width in his shoulders or his stomach region?"
"Shoulders," Rebecca said. "He runs a health club and he always works out."
"Okay,"
said the woman slowly, like she was writing this down.
"Now, I'm just wondering if a large would be too loose around the waist."
"We probably will get married," Rebecca said. "You know, someday."
"Well, of course,"
the woman said.
"What size suit does he wear? That might help us out."
"I don't know if I've ever seen him in a suit."
"Why don't we go with the large?"
the woman said. "I don't usually order things like this," Rebecca told her. "To get sent to me, I mean. And I've never ordered anything online. I'd never give my credit card number online."
"No?"
the woman asked.
Some people feel that way. Some people don't like to order things anyway. You prefer to do your shopping right there in the store. I'm like that myself.
Things get lost, Rebecca told her. There's a lot of billing clerks and truck drivers out there. You know, all those people who could have a bad night's sleep or a fight with their boss. As she spoke, she flipped through the magazine, found the first page of the story when the man had still been happy, and ripped it out slowly. Using the cigarette lighter she kept in her back pocket, Rebecca set the page on fire in the sink.
I suppose if you think about it like that,
the woman said agreeably.
But we guarantee delivery.
Oh, I trust you, Rebecca said, and she did. What a voice that woman had. Rebecca could have told her anything. It's just that I'm the kind of person, Rebecca continued, that thinks if you took a map of the whole world and put a pin in it for every person, there wouldn't be a pin for me. The woman didn't say anything. Do you ever think that? Rebecca asked. She watched the small flame, like a little living spirit, flare up for a moment in the sink.
No,
the woman said.
I never do.
Oh, I'm sorry, Rebecca said.
Don't be sorry,
said the woman.
It's a pleasure. We'll do this. We'll go with the large, and if it's too big, you just send it on back.
Rebecca ran water over the flakes of ashes in the sink. Can I just ask you something? She said to the woman.
Well, sure,
the woman said. Are you a Scientologist?
Am I?
There was a pause.
No, I'm not,
the woman said in her easy southern accent. Me either. It's just I happened to be reading an article about Scientology, and boy, it sounds like pretty weird stuff.
I guess to each his own. Now,
I always talk too much, Rebecca explained to the woman. My boyfriend tells me that, and now I've given myself this headache.
It's a pleasure doing business with a friendly person,
the woman said.
A cold face cloth pressed right against the eyeballs should help. And don't be afraid to really press either.
Thank you, Rebecca said. I guess large will do.
Obviously, you've got to lie right back,
the woman said.
Put the face cloth in the freezer first.
Rebecca Brown came from a line of congregational ministers. Her grandfather had been a much-loved pastor of a large church in Shirley Falls, and her mother had been the daughter of this Reverend Tyler Caskey's second marriage, his first wife dying and leaving him with two small girls. By the time he had married again and had Rebecca's mother, the other girls were old enough to not pay much attention to her, and it wasn't until Rebecca's mother married a minister herself, and then left very suddenly to go to California to be an actress, that Rebecca's Aunt Catherine got involved. It is unthinkable that a mother would take off like that, she said, with tears in her eyes. Except it wasn't unthinkable at all. Rebecca's mother had done it and had not even put up a fight when Rebecca's father, Reverend Brown of a tiny church in Crosby, Maine, had gone to court for custody. This is sick, said Aunt Catherine. He'll spousify you. Let's hope he gets married again soon. Aunt Catherine had had a lot of therapy, and Rebecca was nervous around her. In any event, her father did not remarry, and Rebecca had grown up in a solitary house owned by the church, and had known, quietly and secretly, the way that children know things, that her father was not the minister her grandfather had been. It breaks my heart, Aunt Catherine said once on a visit, and Rebecca hoped she wouldn't come again. Her mother, in California, sent a postcard once in a while, but when it was discovered that she had joined the Church of Scientology, even Aunt Catherine said it was better not to have much to do with her. That wasn't hard. The postcards stopped coming. Rebecca sent a whole bunch of letters, one after another, to her mother at the last address she had for her, in a town called Tarzana. Rebecca never put on a return address because she didn't want her father to find the letters if they got returned, and most likely they would have been returned. The address was 4 years old, and when Rebecca called directory assistance for a telephone number in Tarzana and all the towns nearby, there was no listing for Charlotte Brown or Charlotte Caskey either. Where did the letters go? Rebecca had gone to the library to read about Scientology. She read how they wanted to clear the world of body titans, aliens who they believed inhabited the Earth after a nuclear explosion 75 million years ago. She read how members were required to disconnect from family members who were critical of Scientology, which is why her mother didn't write to her anymore. Maybe writing to Rebecca had been a suppressive act, and her mother had been required to go before the Rehabilitation Project Force. Rebecca read about one member who was told that, with the right training and discipline, he could learn to read people's thoughts. "Come get me," Rebecca thought, hard, to her mother. "Come get me, please." Later on, she thought, "Fuck you." She stopped reading about Scientology and started reading books about being a minister's wife. You were supposed to have a can of fruit cocktail in the pantry in case some parishioner came to call. For a number of years, Rebecca made sure to have fruit cocktail in the cupboard, though it was very seldom that anyone came to call. When she graduated from high school and knew she'd be going 2 hours away to the university, living somewhere else, Rebecca was so dazed to think such good fortune had finally arrived that she worried she'd be hit by a car and become paralyzed and have to live in the rectory forever. But once she was at the university, she sometimes missed her father, and she tried not to think of him alone in that house. When people spoke of their mothers, she would say quietly that her own mother had passed away, which made people uncomfortable, because Rebecca had a way of looking down after she said this, as though to indicate she could not bear to say any more about it. She thought, in a very technical way, what she said was true. She didn't say her mother was dead, which, as far as she knew, wasn't true. Her mother had passed, as in an airplane far above, away to a different land, and Rebecca was quite used to the phases she went through when she thought a great deal about her mother, and then when she did not think about her at all. She did not know anyone else whose mother had run off and never looked back, and she thought her own thoughts about it must be natural, given the circumstances. It was during her father's funeral that Rebecca had the kind of thoughts she knew couldn't be natural, certainly not during a funeral anyway. A shaft of sunlight had come through a window of the church, bouncing off the wooden pew and slanting across the carpet, and the sun like that had made Rebecca want someone. She was 19 years old and had learned some things in college about men. The minister doing the funeral was a friend of her father's. They had gone to seminary together years ago. And watching him up there with his hand raised in a blessing, Rebecca started thinking about things she could do to him under his robe, things he'd have to pray about later.
"Carlton's spirit remains here with us," the minister said,
and goosebumps started all over Rebecca's head. She thought about the psychic woman reading dead people's thoughts, and she got the feeling that her father was right behind her eyeballs, seeing what she was imagining doing to his friend. Then she thought about her mother, that maybe her mother had been taught to read people's thoughts and was reading Rebecca's thoughts right now. Rebecca closed her eyes as though she were praying. "Fuck you," she said to her mother. "Sorry," she said to her father. Then she opened her eyes, looked at the people in the church, as dull-looking as dry sticks. She pictured lighting little piles of papers in the woods. She had always liked the sudden small burst of a flame.
"What have you got there, Bickerbeck?" David asked.
He was sitting on the floor, aiming the remote control at the television, switching channels every time a commercial came on. Above him, on the window pane, were reflections from the television screen, jerking and dancing across the glass. A dental assistant, Rebecca said from where she sat at the table. She circled the ad with her pen. Experience preferred, but they'll train if they have to.
Oh, sweetie, said David, looking at the television. People's mouths?
There was no way around it. Jobs were a problem for her. The only job Rebecca had ever enjoyed was a job she had one summer at the Dream Beam ice cream machine. The manager was drunk every day by 2 o'clock, and he let his help eat all the ice cream they wanted. They'd give the kids who came in huge ice cream cones and watch their eyes get big.
It's okay, the manager would say, weaving between the ice cream freezers. Run the place broke. I don't give a shit.
Right before Rebecca had moved in with David, she'd been a secretary at a big firm of lawyers. Some of the lawyers would buzz her on the phone and tell her to bring them coffee. Even the women lawyers did this. She kept wondering if she had the right to tell them no, but it didn't matter. Within a few weeks, they'd sent a woman over to tell her that she worked too slow.
Remember, sweetie pie, David said, switching channels again. Confidence is the name of the game.
Okay, said Rebecca. She kept on circling the ad for the